This talk was given by Susan Taikyo-Gilman at the Zen Center of New York City. Taikyo is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order and is currently serving as the assistant training coordinator. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everybody. So glad to be here. My name is Taikyo, and Hochin Sensei is just getting back from New Zealand, asked me to be here this week and give this talk today. So she'll be back in full throttle this week. So you can all look forward to that. This is from the translator's introduction to the Metta Sutta. What is it for a spirit to come down on the ground? Is it out of necessity? Or are they appearing when the need arises? So the translator's introduction. While the Buddha was staying at Savatthi, a band of monks, having received subjects of meditation from the master, proceeded to a forest to spend the rainy season. The tree deities inhabiting this forest were worried by their arrival as they had to descend from tree abodes and dwell on the ground. They hoped, however, the monks would soon leave, but finding that the monks would stay a period of 3 months, harassed them in diverse ways during the night with the intention of scaring them away. Living under such conditions being impossible, the monks went to the master and informed him of their difficulties. Thereon, the Buddha instructed them in the Metta Sutta and advised their return, equipped with the sutta for their protection. The monks went back to the forest and, practicing the instruction conveyed, permeated the whole atmosphere with their radiant thoughts of metta, loving kindness. The deities, so affected by this power of love, henceforth allowed them to meditate in peace. So many of you might be familiar with the Metta Sutra. It's not a typical Zen sutra. It's from the original Buddha's teachings in the Pali Canon. And it was, many of these sutras are kind of embedded in Zen practice and in later Zen teachings in the Mahayana, but we don't necessarily chant them. But about over 10 years ago, Shugen Roshi brought this one forward, and the Metta Sutra is something that we've chanted. I chanted it daily for a while, and it's very rich, so I'm going to talk about this sutra today. And so what is it for a spirit to come down out of their tree abode? Why are they coming down? Clearly, they were feeling kind of vulnerable, with these monastics invading their forest. And the monastics who'd been sent there by their teacher to meditate, they were feeling vulnerable. They were hearing things in the night. They were distracted. They were upset. Everybody was feeling disrupted. And I was kind of wondering, this became an opportunity for the Buddha to teach something very fundamental to Buddhist practice, to really like draw it out. And sometimes a teacher will do that, circumstances arise and there's a reason then why this teaching comes forward. And I was also thinking that this kind of was like when need arises, Kanon Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva of compassion, arrives and shows themselves. And Daido Roshi, he was my first teacher and founder of the Mountains and Rivers Order, wrote about precepts, and he was talking about Kanon Bodhisattva and compassion. And he wrote, compassion happens. There's no effort involved. It's not the self that does good. The doing of good is not even known to the self. And he wrote, doing good in complete intimacy is the embodiment and activity of the 10,000 hands and eyes of Kanon Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva of compassion. She's called the hearer of the cries of the world. She's the bodhisattva who responds when someone cries out for help. When she responds in perfect accord with circumstances. She doesn't always appear in the form of a goddess. She may appear in a non-human form. She may appear as a god or a devil. She responds without mind. There's no thought. Kanan does not know about goodness. She doesn't know about doing. Compassion arises spontaneously out of wisdom. The realization of no separation. No separation between me and you. Us, them. Someone falls, you pick the person up. There's no effort involved. So these tree spirits, they were feeling vulnerable. The monks were feeling vulnerable. Are you feeling vulnerable? Do you know people who feel vulnerable right now? Who feel afraid? We're all sharing space with lots of people. People who are vulnerable and feeling afraid. So these spirits that arrive, or the moment that arrives, to take care of something difficult. Have you seen this happen? Maybe you've been that person. Have you seen it on a subway platform? Somebody stepping forward, or in a courtroom, or at a national prayer breakfast, in a passport office? Is it you? There's another story that I really like, and Hojin Sensei brought this forward fairly recently. In the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, the Buddha had been doing an ascetic practice and began to realize that was not the way. And there was this laywoman, Sujata, who was regularly coming to the forest and making offerings to the tree deities with hopes of conceiving a child. And so she was bringing her offering to the forest, and she saw this emaciated person under a tree and thought he was a tree deity. So she offered him her her bowl of milk porridge and helped revive the Buddha and continue giving offerings till he regained his strength and then realized himself. So there's a real relationship here in the early teachings with the, you know, the many deities that are embodying themselves and showing up. So the Buddha was nourished, and maybe he understood that the tree spirits later in the forest, they needed something too. They needed some nourishment, and they needed something from the monastics. That was the circumstances. And so he taught this sutra so that everybody could calm down, everybody could feel safe, despite being vulnerable in this forest full of unknown things, and that they could get on with the important work in harmony, the work of being a tree deity, the work of being a monastic, the work of being a human in the world. So the sutra begins with what I feel like are instructions in Zazen. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. And these teachings is also starting to bring out something called, you know, Buddhism loves numbers, but these are called the five hindrances. And I'm just going to mention them. They deserve their own talk. But and the hindrances are, you know, grasping desires, aversion, restlessness and worry, sloppiness, laziness, and doubt about the Dharma. And these five hindrances are kind of embedded in the sutra in a beautiful way. And the sutra goes on, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Wishing in gladness and in safety, May all beings be at ease. So there's another teaching on loving kindness that was part of this kind of series of sutras called Discourse on Advantages of Loving Kindness. And it spoke about loving kindness as the release of the heart. The release of the heart. So check in with your heart. How is it? Is it vulnerable? Is it open? Is it tight? What's release? Release of the heart. It's hard. And the things that kind of get in the way, you know, for me right now, it's a little anxiety. You know, here I am, my palms are sweaty. It's hard talking in front of a lot of people. And sometimes it's grasping, whatever it is, those hindrances. The Buddha also said they're like things covering up water. The water is disrupted. And maybe it's the wind that's picking the water up. You can't really see reflection clearly. Maybe it's rain that's come and muddied up the water. You can't really see anything clearly. Or it's plants that are covering up the water. And goes through all the different hindrances as being all these different kinds of disruptions that happen on our clear, calm mind. The mind that doesn't know disruption. And so maybe the wind is stirring us up. Maybe that's why we've come to practice. Maybe that's why you came here today, feeling a disruption. Maybe we don't know what's really happening. And so there's that sense of tightness, worry, sort of living in it. How is it to be wise and skillful when you don't really know what's happening? How do we be wise? And the sutra says, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, forsaking none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. May all beings be at ease. That's the great heart of Bodhisattva. And the Buddha was teaching these monastics and these tree deities to turn territoriality, hey, that's my space. And competition, I'll show you, into peaceful and skillful coexistence. I think skillful is an important word in this sutra too. Like, I think we all know what's unskillful, right? You know, somebody's aggressive and mean to you and you just get aggressive and mean back and suddenly you're just like, not skillful. But the Buddha has said that meeting hatred with hatred will never appease hatred. It's with love only that will appease hatred. It's a tough practice. It's tough. But this practice is for us. It's for you. This loving heart, that's for you. That's for me. So for those of you who had beginning instruction in Zazen today, and we talked about breath, focusing on the breath, and seeing a thought and letting it go, and returning to your breath, this is the practice of seeing those hindrances. You know, five is not a lot, right? It's, you would think that would be it. There's a teacher... There's a teacher Yeah, what page am I on here? Sylvia Boorstein, and she wrote this wonderful book, and she, one of the chapters is called The Limited Menu of Disturbing Mind States. And she named these five energies. She calls them energies. And traditionally, they're called lust, aversion, torpor, restlessness, and doubt, doubt about the Dharma, which is different than self-doubt. And she likened it to like sandstorms that just sort of like cloud your vision. We think that the storm is everything. We forget about our essential, true, calm, clear nature because it's all about the storm. They confuse us. We think they're real. We forget that our actual nature is not the passing storm. The passing storm is just the passing storm. Our essence remains our essence all the time. And she wrote, our difficult mind states become a problem only if we believe they are going to go on forever. Then, because they are uncomfortable energies, they start to frighten us. Sound familiar? Like those monastics in the forest, like those tree deities. We think this is going to be forever. And she says, because we become frightened as soon as a difficult mind state blows into the mind, we start to fight with it. We try to change it, or we try to get rid of it. The frenzy of the struggle makes the mind state even more unpleasant. And isn't this true? And you feel, you know, claustrophobic in your mind state. You know, you just want to make it go away. And we forget. She says, the best solution would be non-alarmed recognition. And she likens it to stepping in something sticky, you know. You try a little harder to get it off your shoes, but you can't. It's just getting, you're getting more stuck. It's picking up dirt. You know, non-alarmed recognition. Just take your shoes off, right? Get out. It's just a sticky thing. That's all. The world's a lot bigger than that sticky thing. So we work with these hindrances, you know, when they come, and learn to not make such a big deal out of them. It's just a passing state. There's more to see. So the sutra shifts in the middle. Once the monastics settle down, they recognize some hindrances. They're peaceful, calm, wise, skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. The sutra says, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether walking or standing, seated or lying down, all those postures of the Buddha, one should sustain this recollection. So think about that. Protects with her life. You know, this is not a casual kind of act. This is a full-on, protective, selfless activity. This mother protects her child, her only child. So, with a boundless heart, should one cherish all living beings, starting here and outward. And the challenge of loving kindness, I wrote this, so I must believe it, is to feel it in the body when fear is actually what is present. How to, like, start to counter that, you know, replace that with kindness, loving kindness. Maybe it's just by doing a kind act. Maybe it's by breathing in that tightness and exhaling love. That's it. That's skillful, right? To see what's happening, acknowledge it, take some action. There's another teaching that related to this for me. It's, again, Buddhism loves numbers. These are called the seven factors of awakening. And relate this to how we do Zazen. They're traditionally taught in three groupings. The first is called a balancing factor, and that's mindfulness. So it balances our body-mind awareness, mindfulness. Mindfulness of your breath and your body, mindfulness of your thoughts. The next three are called energizing factors: investigation, energy, and rapture. So investigation is like that turning in and asking, what's present? What is this? What's this state? And from that investigation, energy. And in that energy and that release, a kind of pleasure. It's pleasant. It's pleasant to really feel yourself calm, feel your mind. So that's energizing. And the next three are called calming factors: tranquility or calm, concentration, and equanimity. And these seven factors are present in practice. And that concentration helps kind of the feedback loop of being able to be mindful and present and release the hindrances. And speaking up from the basis of calm and wisdom and skillfulness, you know, there are times in our life where we want to speak up. We want to be skillful. And again, I went back to Daido Roshi when he was talking about the moral and ethical precepts. I've been spending some time with something, a teaching, I'll say a little bit more about it, that is being held in some of our more sort of good work, right action spaces. So our Green Dragon Ecosattvas have taken this up. It's called Block, Build, and Be. And I realized that this teaching actually comes from, because it's come through sort of Buddhist teachings, contemporary Buddhist teachings, it comes from what's called the three pure precepts, which are stop creating evil, practice good, and actualize good for others. And these are three of the precepts in the 16 Bodhisattva precepts that are taken up in Zen in this lineage. And these pure precepts are embodiments of selflessness. So they're how we begin to walk Bodhisattva path. So I went back to Daido Roshi, and he writes, practice, you know, Zazen, Zen practice, bringing it into activity, is not a means for attaining enlightenment, but a manifestation of enlightenment itself. When we practice the precepts, we manifest that same enlightenment. The precepts are the definition of the life of a Buddha. And these three pure precepts, he says, are pure by virtue of their all-encompassing nature. They sort of wrap around everything. Very simple practice. And I really connected with this when I first began practice. Like, just stop, right? Mahapajapati, she's got that up. Just stop. Stop. Stop creating evil. This is a teaching. Practice good. Just good. And then actualize good for others in your life, just by what you do. And he writes, Daido Roshi writes, the basis of the precepts is the absolute basis of reality, the realization of no self. We chanted it today, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No self. But no self does not function in the world amid the daily turmoil and distractions. How do we make it function? It manifests in a form that is in accord with the circumstances. At the same time, it's not hindered by those same circumstances. Manifesting in the world, actualizing good for others, becomes the life of a bodhisattva. You know, again, back to Kanon Bodhisattva, doesn't think about it, just does. Just does. Compassion just happens. Because compassion is present. The sutra says, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. And in a sense, the perspective from the Mahayana is that we're not born again into the world of samsara. We're not creating suffering. You know, this isn't so much about being born in some far-off nirvana. This is about being born into your life. You know, practicing those two sides, bringing them together in your heart. So I went back to kind of dig into where did this block build and be come from, you know, this way of stopping creating evil, practicing good, actualizing good for others. And I traced it back to one of our Dharma elders, Joanna Macy, who some of you might know, who was developed over many years of activist work from a Buddhist perspective, something called the work that reconnects. She has a teaching called The Great Turning, which is this idea that in a sense we are in a turning age now, within so much Dharma permeating the West and evolving into a kind of alive, embodied practice out of the monasteries, just like in our lives. That the great turning, in a sense, is the work of each one of us. It's the work of doing good. And she and her team, because it's now a team, the dimensions of the great turning are shifting to a way of living and political economy that serves and sustains life. So very simple, right? Not so easy to do. And that not creating evil in this collection of teachings is holding actions in defense of life, blocking that which causes harm. So there are, activities for divestment and changing legislation and work from the grassroots up in all levels of our world that are blocking harm and that continue. And they continue because individuals do this work and we do it together. So holding actions in defense of life, practicing good, transforming the foundations of our common life. And this is a way of looking at things from a more worldwide perspective rather than a kind of nationalistic view. And transforming the foundations of our common life, looking at water and earth and air and weapon systems and minerals. And, this work continues on many different levels. Some of you may be involved. And then actualizing good for others shifts in perception and values. And this is the be part. This is how do we be true in our own lives to what we value and what sustains life. And there are so many ways that this work kind of calls us. It definitely has brought me into practice, beginning years. The Buddhist Peace Fellowship is another thing, another body that took up and sort of refined this into what's called Block, Build, and Be. That's where we kind of got the words from, the Green Dragon Ecosattvas. And Buddhist Peace Fellowship, I remember finding them when I was in high school because I'd been sort of a member of the American Friends Service Committee, but I wasn't really Quaker, but I appreciated the work. And so I found the Buddhist Peace Fellowship is kind of like the Buddhist, you know, equivalent of the American Friends Service Committee, just sort of gathering people of religion and faith to do good work. And so it's still very dear to my heart as they shift and change. So I wanted to bring forward this sutra because I feel like it can really offer each of us a way to kind of land with how do we work with calming our minds and becoming skillful. It's a nice sutra to chant by yourself, really slowly or quickly. And in thinking about, you know, these spirits that embody the trees and the rocks, and that embody our apartments and buildings and, you know, lampposts, and that move through each of us. You know, I was just thinking about that and how Kanhan Bodhisattva moves and enlivens our hearts. And I thought of this poem, which I will offer part of to kind of bring this to a close. And it's by one of my favorite poets, Ross Gay. And it's called To the Mulberry Tree. And I'm going to spare you some of the depth of it because it's kind of long. But I'll give you the beginning. He writes, "Everyone knows it's good luck, if inconvenient, when a bird shits on you. But even more so, good luck if the bird shits on you when you're plucking gold currant tomatoes, sweet enough to make your bare feet lift just so off the ground." And he goes into this reverie, which I will spare you. But he notices that, yes, this shit is mostly berry. It's purple and goopy. It's got seeds. And it draws him to this nearby mulberry tree that he knows quite well, this tree. And he writes, "Mostly, I'm happy. The birds feast on the topmost branches of these tall trees and leave be for the time being my blueberries and my blackberries and grapes and these little tomatoes, though to be sure, it's with a certain glee as spring gasps into summer and the lowest branches shimmer with their simple booty, which I must jump for and sometimes high, which I will not probably always be able to do, for jumping and grabbing at once like this, a soft thing, is hard. Be gentle," she said, emerging from the dugout beneath the mulberry tree, where the big kids gathered, and we mostly rode by on our bikes fast so as not to be snatched to the ground and pummeled, or worse, for they were teenagers. But I knew this early July morning, they'd be nowhere to be found. And the tree would be burdened with a crop, begging to be loosened on my ice cream. She wiped her eyes, yawned, and put on glasses. And there was in her hair a small sprig of grass. And she was barefoot, laughing and filling with me slowly my bucket, eating a few when it was full, giggling at the small burst of juice one made on her chin. And behind her, beneath the tree, there was a filthy blanket and a pack of cigarettes and tin foil wrappers, crumpled and shimmering, and the frayed remnants of a rope. And seeing me, seeing into the terrible future, she put softly one hand on my chin and the other in my hair, turning my head away from that wreckage, waiting in there, and back to the leaves, which I too will do to you so that none of us will ever die terribly, and stay always like this, lips and fingers blushed purple, the faint sugar ghosting our mouths, beneath the tree inside me, which is the same tree now grown inside you. And the three of us snugged in the canopy on our tippy toes, gathering fruit for good. So as we go forth from here, gathering fruit for good, do that and offer it. You know, as we offer our lives together. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.